Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in the intriguing series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the Top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of other ways you can listen to other forms of this interview. And now it's time for this interview with the director of Wakatu Incorporation, Mariana Stevens. Mariana is the first of two guests on the theme of joining the dots, everything is connected, with the second guest being Dr. Olivia Hyatt, who, among many other things, is a director of Zero Carbon Nelson Tasman. Here is the first conversation with Mariana Stevens. I do hope you enjoy it. It's wonderful that Mariana Stevens is able to join us today to share her integrative view of climate and local government. Mariana holds degrees in the arts and in law, is a director of Wakatu Incorporation in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, and is of Ngāti Rārua, Ngāti Rangi, and Ngāti Ranganui descent. Mariana and I first met when she was doing a wonderful job leading the development of the visionary intergenerational strategy for Te Tauihu, known as Tupuna Pono, being good ancestors. Tēnā koe, Mariana, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Climate Matters.
Kia ora, Lindsay.
Kia ora. Okay, well, look, if I may, I'd like to start with the intergenerational strategy Tupuna Pono itself. I love the being good ancestors concept that underlies it, and the strategy impresses me both with its holistic approach to nature and humanity and considerations of a time span that I think would astonish most listeners, 500 years. As I understand it, a holistic view and a long-time horizon are both intrinsic to Te Ao Māori, and of course they are highly relevant to climate considerations as well. Would you kindly frame for us the core concepts that underpin Te Ao Māori in these respects and suggest how we could better employ them to improve society at large and our present systems of local government in particular?
Thank you, Lindsay. And firstly, you know, I just want to acknowledge that I'm not an expert in Te Ao Māori, and the views that I will share today are my own,
which
have
understood.
Really shaped by my upbringing, experiences, and my connection to Te Tauihu, the people and the place that I call home.
Thank you.
Te Ao Māori, a Māori worldview, acknowledges the interconnectedness and interrelationship of all living and non-living things. It is, as you said, a holistic approach that seeks to understand the total system, not just parts of it.
Mm.
I often think of it as a community of relationships, and as we as human beings are part of this community, we rely on nature, and nature relies on us. And by acknowledging this connection, we thrive together. But fundamentally, it's about respect, responsibility, and balance. You referred to the Te Tauihu Intergenerational Regional Strategy and the vision for the strategy, Tupuna Pono, to be good ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And at the heart of the strategy is really the well-being of people and places in Te Tauihu, Oranga Te Tauihu, with a particular focus on the well-being of current and future generations and the responsibility we have as the current generation to pass on the taonga of Te Tauihu in a better state than when these taonga were placed in our care. And this is very much a Te Ao Māori way of being. We recognise that economic, environmental, social and cultural well-being are interconnected and they're interdependent. So if we are to improve our communities at large, then some of our current leadership structures, and I'm not talking about the people, I'm talking about the structures and the model.
Yeah, good point.
Needs to be changed as we cannot continue with the machine of bureaucracy that continually creates silos. You know, our system is broken.
Yeah.
And I think our way forward is to demonstrate a genuine partnership between Māori and Pākehā, and that Te Tiriti is our opportunity. If we're really prepared to show some maturity, if we're prepared to have the kōrero and open our hearts and our minds.
Mm.
So a shared understanding of the importance of this can, I think, really unite, and it can guide us as we forge a new way forward for our regions, for our region and the communities that we serve.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Mariana. There were a few things that struck me. Right at the beginning, you talked about a community of relationships, and I think that's a lovely way of phrasing it. There's increasing discussion of a circular economy, both for emissions reduction and for resource preservation, because, of course, we're testing the planetary boundaries in terms of resource depletion. And people like Kate Raworth, who you may have heard of, disrupted conventional Western economic thinking with her donut economics theory. However, it seems to me that Indigenous cultures often run circular economies almost by default. And I know that Tena Boasa Dean put forward a Maori version of Raworth's donut, which I found actually even more profound. It expressed a different relationship between the environment and people, but still in a generally circular form. Can you please give us some insight into how such circularity infuses Maori thinking, and whether there's much difference between traditional and modern Maori perspectives in this?
Yeah, you know, there are, I think, many examples of circularity in Te Ao Māori. You know, through Waiata, and actually it's a Waiata that I sung when I was in Japan, talks about, you know, the cycle of plants from, you know, from germination, Jason, right till it's, you know, to the full cycle, and yeah. And really how you need to have resilience. You know, we talk a lot about needs to be nurtured and all of, you know, through that cycle. Through kōrero, you know, we talk about tāne separating earth and sky.
Yes.
And
yes.
The means by which light came into the world, the cycle of the sun, you know, from darkness to light. And you mentioned, you know, the donut economy, and actually that was referred to through the work that we were doing with the Te Tauihu Intergenerational Strategy. And I think it's really helpful to look at different models and frameworks. But what was really, I think, important for us when the work that we did was it had to be owned by the community. So the community had to really, you know, design and take the strategy forward. So In the intergenerational strategy, we used that analogy. We used the analogy, the circular analogy, and many orators would say this, you know, ki te whaiao, ki te taiao, ki te ao marama, which is the cycle of emerging from darkness to light. And really, you know, to be give us the foundation to be able to tackle the big issues, you know, of climate inequity, access to housing, regenerative farming, etc. When you look at how we frame the intergenerational strategy, that circular structure is pretty much at the forefront of the strategy. I often try to imagine what the past was like. I guess as we evolve as human beings, we see that past, or we see that past or that traditional way of being through the lens of our own knowledge and experience. And it can be, you know, quite a complex and dynamic state. And through colonization, some of our traditional worldview has changed. And I think some of this for the good and some of this for the not so good. But with change, you know, there are always constants, and, you know, it's the importance of ensuring that our identity, and especially for Māori through our reo, our language, our tikanga, our customary practices and values, you know, it's protected, it's used, and it's adhered to. So survival, courage and resilience.
Sorry, was that survival? Was that what you said?
Yeah, survival, you know, courage and resilience are what we share as generations. And I think more importantly for Māori, whakapapa, you know, our connection to each other,
yes.
Past, present and future. And also, of course, as I've mentioned, you know, our connection to our natural world. So some of the changes that I've experienced through my lifetime and, you know, again, as I reflect, you know, I do think as citizens and as communities, we have become quite wasteful. And in some instances, we lack discipline. You know, for my grandparents' generation, when I was living with them, you know, our cupboard was the moana, it was the ocean, it was the ngahere, the forest. And, you know, and now some of our children, and especially through COVID, you know, think the supermarket grows our kai.
Yes, that's right.
And so very much that. And, you know, and also growing up with my grandparents, you know, I didn't know rubbish tins were a thing until I went to school. Mm. And so zero waste was just the norm in my household. You know, we recycled, upcycled. We only took what we needed when it came to food. And, you know, and I think about the big gardens we grew, not just for ourselves, but also to feed the wider community. And especially when you had seasonal workers coming into town, you know, often they came with nothing. And so to be able to provide them with food and clothing, you know, was an essential service. So when I look at tradition in the past, I look at where we are currently in the future. You know, I do think there's an opportunity, Lindsay, to be able to weave some of our traditional knowledge and ways and practices of doing things, you know, our mātauranga, with, you know, modern ways of doing things, whether that's through, you know, some of the science, the innovation and the technologies, you know, to meet some of the, you know, the big challenges and opportunities, you know, of our time. And so combining the best of those knowledge systems and hands-on experience, you know, I'm hoping as communities we're able to develop these skills further, these systems further, practices, and a deeper understanding of, you know, how we can work in harmony with our natural world. And I do acknowledge there's lots of initiatives happening in this space, but I do think working together, tradition, innovation, you know, is key to this.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall in some of those discussions. They sound fascinating. I just want to do a little sideways step, if I may. When you're talking about you didn't know what a rubbish bin was till you went to school, I sometimes wonder if that sort of philosophy is partly because a lot of Indigenous communities are centred on natural materials rather than industrial materials. And to my mind, natural materials don't go to waste in the way that industrial materials do, like plastic or bits of metal and stuff. Does that resonate at all with you? Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, again, you know, just as we've evolved as communities, you know, there are, you know, and I think about a lot about plastics. I mean, we never had plastic bags. You know, I can't really remember them, and they came in a period. But I do think, you know, we lived quite simply. So I think as we get more things sort of pushed at us, we tend to take on those things more. And so therefore, you know, and, you know, it is about doing a little bit of a reset in terms of how we live.
Mirjana, I'd like to move in a slightly different direction now. In the climate change sense especially, the term a just transition crops up quite a lot to do with trying to make the changes equitable across all sectors of society. And the efforts of this government to incorporate well-being into policy has been quite a feature of it. But I've got deep concerns that social inequities are not only still getting greater, but they'll be exacerbated as the challenges of the climate crisis unfold. And while this might be aggravated by aspects of colonialization, I think it goes beyond that and is also a serious issue in countries with no notable colonial past. From your perspective, what do you suggest as key strategies now for securing better just transition outcomes for people generally in the future? And if you had a magic council wand, here's a magic wand for you, madam. If you had a magic council policy wand, what would you magic to the top of their agenda to help in this?
I fundamentally believe that communities, tangata whenua and business, we know the issues, we know the answers, and therefore we must be enabled to be able to provide the solutions. So I think that's probably the first point that I want to make. If we think that government and local government are going to provide the answers and the solutions, that's not going to happen. And that's really, you know, one of the key reasons why we convened the Te Sauihu Intergenerational Regional Strategy. You know, it was a really important that the people of Te Tauihu were able to identify the challenges, identify the priorities and the actions that actually, you know, that need to happen.
Can I interrupt you briefly there? Because a lot of listeners might not know much about the process that you went through with the Te Tau Iu intergenerational strategy. And I just want to say, I thought it was a most impressive process with inclusive of all sorts. Some people might think, oh, it was just for local iwi or whatever, but it went so much wider than that and embraced councils as well as all sectors of society. So I just, sorry to interrupt you, but I think it's quite important that listeners have a bit of a sense of that, again, a holistic dimension to it. Sorry, I stopped you in mid-train there.
No. And I think that's, you know, it's a really good point, Lindsay, because when we came up with the idea that, and, you know, you talked about that 500-year intergenerational, you know, vision, and that's, you know, especially, you know, how we at Wakatū, you know, that's definitely our approach. Mm. We're here for the long term. And, you know, and so are many businesses too in the region. You know, we're not necessarily here for a three-year cycle. And so, therefore, you have to be able to think, you know, you have to have that approach. And so that's why it was really important that whānau hapū iwi businesses, that we had to step up in the first instance to be able to, you know, have, you know, start the conversation. I think the strategy, it was ambitious. It's the first one in Aotearoa New Zealand that has
been... Oh, I didn't know that. Wonderful.
Yeah, that has been convened like we have. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, that engagement. And we, you know, when you've got kaupapa or topics like climate change and, you know, some of these big challenges, they can often be quite scary. Mm. And so what we wanted to do was to reframe, you know, some of the sessions that we had, you know, about courageous leadership, about building resilient communities, you know, and so therefore I was hoping when we did that we would be able to engage more because it's not so sort of scary. And having these sessions, you know, at marae, at the local cafe, at the, you know, at centres where people could feel they could be part of the kōrero.
And they were in their comfort zone when they were engaging with it. Yeah.
Yeah, online, you know, a lot of people like to engage online. So, you know, when you're having, you know, 20,000 plus people coming in online in the sessions.
That's astonishing, you know, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. And so we knew that the current system that we have in place will not deliver at the pace we require. Mm. And actually, you know, it takes a generation, I think, to be able to stand up and say, you know, potentially enough is enough. And when I think about the strategy in its totality, you know, one of the striking things that came out of it was the fact that we need a new leadership model in the region. We need targeted investment to drive through the actions that have been identified. Mm-hmm. And until that new leadership model is in place, we will continue to see incremental change and not the transformational change that is required to address, you know, a better future for our region. So if I had a magic wand, Lindsay.
Yes, please use it.
What I'd like to wave is, you know, is that new regional leadership model that is focused on priorities for the region, getting the money investment that this region needs. You know, and we have actually developed the first iteration of our model, but we just need the pūtea investment to make it happen and also, to implement the priorities and actions in the strategy.
Oh, well, I hope your magic spell works, actually, Mariana. I'd like to bounce something off you there because you talked about earlier about the problems with the silo model that we've got and bureaucracy and so on. And what you're talking about in a way I see as a potential solution to that. Some of the other wonderful guests we've had have also talked about similar things, perhaps from a Pākehā perspective, but I suspect pointing in the same direction, like the need for more maybe citizens' assemblies as a way of coming together and not only generating a better policy, but the community having better ownership of it as well. Does that tie in at all with what you're talking about, that sort of thing?
Oh, it definitely does. And, you know, and that's why the strategy, whilst, you know, Māori, you know, whilst and, you know, in business we convened it, we know we can't do the transformation that is required by ourselves. Hmm. So, you know, I always come back to, you know, this is about, you know, it is about partnership. You know, exactly what you're saying, there are different approaches. Mm-hmm. And the Citizens Assembly actually came up in the regional strategy. You know, it's a bit like, I think they might have it, if, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, in places like Scotland, you know, some of the big issues.
Mm-hmm. Ireland people, had it.
Yeah, it might be Ireland, sorry. Yeah.
No, you're right. There are other places, but it's one of the well-known examples.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, and it's traditionally, you know, I know that there have been hapū iwi groups that have done that on the past with the bigger issues. You'll have a wānanga, and you come in and you will sit through that. It might be a weekend, it might be a week, it might be for longer. But you know, that's how you get the people's, I guess, you know, their thoughts, their approaches. And as you mentioned, the ownership to be able to solve, some of those challenges. So
yes.
I think there's definitely synergies and alignment there.
Fascinating. I'd like to jump tracks quite a big way now, please, Mariana. And it's the thing that's interested me quite a lot. There have been recurring situations where marae have proven to be anchor amenities in times of disaster, in spite sometimes of quite modest local Māori populations. And one that comes to my mind is the marae in Kaikoura when they had the earthquake there a few years ago. Marae are, of course, not just buildings, but signify important cultural dimensions that I wonder if are perhaps lacking or a lot weaker in Pākehā societies. Do you think there's a lesson here for society overall? And if so, how do you think we might progressively encourage society at large to develop in such a direction?
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate in that I grew up at Te Āwhina Marae in Motueka. It was really my home. So for me, it was a place where I was able to speak to reo Māori, sing, laugh, you know, have a lot of fun, host. You know, we talk a lot about manaakitanga, but it was service, you know, at its best. And it was, I just have such, you know, fond memories growing up there, community at the marae. And actually I bumped into a farmer from Motueka a few months back, and he said, you know, him and his brother used to ride past on their bikes on the marae, past the marae, and they always used to hear all the laughter coming out. And then one day they got invited in and, you know, they were playing cards and all sorts of things. And they said, oh, you know, it was the fun, it was the cool place to be hung out, because it was a place where, you know, they felt happy and they belonged. But it's also very important, I know, for our families and particularly, you know, it's where our culture and our customs and practices, you know, are revered, and really a place where we're in control. You know, I think that's quite an important point to make. Everything is on our terms, which is not necessarily what we experience when we're out.
No, and they become sort of almost like an oasis in that broader context, don't they?
Correct. You know, and so, you know, I think it's a real focal point for us as whānau and as kin to come together. You know, it's where we grieve. It's where we have courted or debate, where we get the opportunity to restore and rejuvenate ourselves. To learn and ultimately, you know, as I've said, you know, to be us. But I do think there is a real opportunity for our marae to take more of a centre stage. You mentioned the Kaikoura earthquakes. I think when they had the fires, you know, in the region a couple of years back, what was interesting in that is that when people had to come, you know, out of their homes, they came to the marae to stay. And what was an interesting point around that is they didn't just come, you know, with themselves. They came with their pets.
Okay.
And, you know, often, you know, pets are part of people's families.
They are. That's right.
And marae aren't really geared up to have pets.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so, therefore, you know, and I think as we go through, you know, I was thinking about the Te Āwhina Marae redevelopment, and that if there are, you know, instances of disasters and things that are happening in our communities, that we do need to make sure we provision where people can have their, you know, have their animals with them. So, you know, I know it's a sort of a moot point, but you sometimes, again, you know, as you go through these experiences, the learnings and how people live and all of those sorts of things, you know, become considerations.
I don't think it is a moot point. I think it's a case of a bit of fusion going on, isn't it, where people are adjusting their way of doing things to cope with sort of broader issues. I actually like that sort of process.
Yeah, and so when I think about marae, and you know, at Te Āwhina pre-COVID, we finished our cultural tourism project, and you know, I've always been a fundamental believer that marae should be our visitor centres. You know, I think the tourism plans, and, you know, they talk about manaakitanga. Well, if you're really talking about manaakitanga and hosting appropriately and properly, and what is really our true point of difference is a country, it is Māori. And so therefore, to be able to welcome visitors, Maruhiri coming in, they should have a pōwhiri. And so it's those sorts of things that I think, this is what the uniqueness, that we can also provide. I think also as the families, we've made a real commitment that traditionally we talk about papakāinga. And papakāinga is not just houses, but it's a way of life. And so the marae fundamentally giving that that cultural wellness. It's also the fact that marae, Te Awhena has secured funding to build 20 new homes for our families to be able to live now on the marae, have access to
That's great.
Quality housing, to be able to participate more in marae life. I think, from a wellbeing perspective, that's going to be hugely beneficial in the opportunity for us to work with our other entities to be able to extend that lifestyle and that responsibility, that reciprocity, I think is going to be, truly one of the great things that we do. Training and education is another big push for us at the marae. So if we look at, training our kaitiaki of the future when it comes to the wellbeing of our lands, future enterprises, health, trades, tech, technologies, we want to be that provider of learning and training for new ways and approaches of doing things.
Good on you.
So I guess my final response to you in terms of marae, I do think they can and they should play a more prominent role in our communities. I think that they can provide, wonderful well-being outcomes, but then that also needs to be balanced, I guess, with the commitment that we have to our, to our whānau and our hapū as well. So it's just, how we balance that and manage that moving forward.
Oh, how interesting. I wouldn't mind teasing out a little bit the relationship between marae and society at large, because it's not that hard to see that in the time of a disaster, that's a wonderful community amenity and it has a special role. But if we look at a broader role through society, and I'm personally of the belief that society at large could benefit a lot from the sort of amenities, an underplaying word, but the sort of amenities and scope and richness that marae bring. But I wouldn't like the general society to hijack the Māori concept of marae. And so I'm interested to know whether you feel that there's a case for enlarging marae as they are or making them more infused, or whether there is maybe an option or a preference for a parallel sort of event. I mean, I think at one time churches may have played that role, but they're a relatively minor part of a community now.
Yeah, I think I can only really offer because like I said, I've had that upbringing, at my marae, so that works and it's fundamental to myself, and I know especially the whānau and the hapū and the iwi. So that's our way of being. And if we are to invite others in, and of course, when I think about Te Awhena and you think about the name of Te Awhena, it means to support and care for. And of course, we want to be able to do that to the wider community, but we can only do that if we are culturally, strong.
Yes, yeah, good
and
point.
So that's the first fundamental thing for us and the build of the well-being of our whānau, hapū and iwi. So I think that's fundamentally really quite important, because when we're
point.
Strong, then we can share with others. And I know that that churches and other places of community spaces are really important, not just to Pākehā, but also to Māori as well. But what I'm saying is that when we're culturally fit and strong, we certainly want to be, I think, and more inclusive of others.
Yeah.
And Te Awhena Marae has had a great history of that, because, through colonisation, urbanisation, a lot of our people aren't living back on the lands. They had to move away for work. And so therefore we've had to rely on others to help support and maintain, to keep our marae stronger, you know, to keep the strength of the marae going. And there's not a day I know that our families aren't grateful for that service that many mātā, waka, you know, Māori from other communities, when they came in for seasonal working, have helped us. Many Pākehā have helped us along our way to the journey. So, you know, we're in a phase and stage of where we are, whereby we want to culturally be strong, we want to get our people back to the marae, and then we want to be open for others to be able to. So I hope I'm not sure if I'm answering your question properly, Lindsay.
No, I think you are. And in a way, as you were talking, I was thinking that seems to me another manifestation of the Tupuna Pono approach, where you know, you're taking this long-term view, and the start of it is to consolidate and strengthen your own family, and then you're in a position to move forward in a stronger way.
And just probably my last point on that was that identity and belonging through the intergenerational regional strategy was really important for everybody.
Yes. Interesting.
And so having those places and spaces where people can connect into, knowing the history, knowing the people, you know, was really important. So, you know, again, that's another big priority area for the regional strategy. And, you know, I think when people have, are strong in their identity, they know where they belong, and makes them more open and willing, I think, to, you know, be more inclusive and share. So that's something I think, you know, needs further work. But I certainly, for me, the marae is the heartbeat and centre of where that happens.
Fabulous. Oh, you've spoken so well about it, Miriana. Thank you. I want to jump tack again, because I've been to the last couple of agricultural climate conferences that have been run, well, through the Ag Research Centre and places like that. And each of them has had speakers from Māori farms. And I've been struck both by the large scale of Māori farming and also some of their innovative approaches to things, such as closely integrating the ecosystem and the community and the farm. I'm interested in the broader application of Indigenous knowledge, especially across our nature-based activities. And I'd be really interested in your view of this and whether the foregoing farming example is a case in point.
Yeah, sure. So I'll probably start with, you know, as we know, Māori have always had a relationship with the whenua, with the land, you know, as gardeners, as providores, et cetera. You know, a good example of this, and I'm talking traditionally from a whānau hapū base, you know, this was in Motueka. So, you know, Motueka was both, you know, a garden and a forest. It was dominated by rimu in Southern Rata. Was rich with, you know, mātai, tītuki, rimu, tōtara. And it had a, you know, an abundant bird life. And beneath that canopy, you know, were niko palms, tree ferns, and many other fruit-bearing and edible plants. So our ancestors, they cultivated gardens around the trees, and, you know, in the form of, I think, you know, what they today they call companion planting.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, this was our traditional way of gardening, where we didn't eradicate all other species and create a monoculture, but instead we had a, you know, really strong biodiversity approach, and our crops, you know, coexisted with these giant trees. So Motueka was, you know, really well known for volumes of potatoes, you know, Māori potatoes. And then early and more recently, you know, and recently with, there was introduced European varieties, and along with kumara, kamokamo, and other crops. And, you know, we were trading those both here in Nelson at, you know, Matangi Afil, which is just over, you know, not far from where I'm speaking from today. And especially when we were feeding the waves of, you know, settlers that were coming in to the region. So in Motueka, Te Mātū, you know, we called the big garden. And so that was the name of our gardens. So this was gardening at scale. And perhaps maybe, you know, as we progress, so we were farming. But, you know, over the time, you know, when we have been alienated from our lands, you know, that's really prevented us from having a connection with the land. And so a lot of traditional practices and ways of how we were gardening and farming have been lost. And, you know, I don't have to think about, you know, the experience at Waka too. You know, when some of our lands became off perpetual leases, or when we got some of our lands back, you know, we haven't had a treaty settlement. But through a regime, our lands have come back to us. Well, we've inherited, you know, crops of, you know, kiwi fruit, apples, pears, et cetera. And so that's now what we're farming.
Yes.
So, you know, that's just what we've got back. But what we recognise is that there's an opportunity now for us to transition back to more of a regenerative estate that's based on our tikanga and our, which is, you know, around our customary practices. This is not going to happen overnight. We're on a journey. We don't have all the answers, but we certainly made a commitment to do that transition over time, which may mean that we are farming. We're farming differently. Of course, we've got different crops. You know, there could be you know, a change of land use and all of that. So I'm quite excited about the opportunity, what's coming ahead of us. And perhaps the two, you know, the couple of examples that you've seen is that transition or commitment to change the way that we're gardening and that we're farming. So our mātauranga, our traditional knowledge, is at the core of this. And we often talk about Māori, and Māori is, you know, it's the life force or energy and vitality of Te Taiao, our natural world. So every living thing, including, you know, plants, animals, water, people, our soils and rocks, even rocks have a motive.
Yes, yep, I'm with you.
And so when our Te Taiao, our natural world and its ecosystems, you know, are in balance, you know, it strengthens and invigorates the Māori, and it is healthy and it's well. So we operate under, you know, a separate a set of principles, and these principles are that firstly, and they follow the principles of Te Mana o Te Wai. So, you know, firstly, that our land and our water, our air and all of our living things, you know, must be able to thrive without overuse. The second principle is that any use is a privilege, not a right.
What a lovely concept. Yep, I think that's a great way of framing it. Thank you.
And then the third principle is everything, you know, if things are not healthy or well, then we must fix it. So, you know, very simple ways of thinking about our relationship with our natural world, and, you know, and that's the heart of our approach.
Yeah, well, and I think it's a wonderful approach, but I couldn't help thinking that's a big job ahead of you too.
Yep, correct. And we can't do it alone, so, and it's going to take some time.
No, I didn't want
to. We're on the journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, good on you. Well, look, I'm thoroughly enjoying talking with you, Mariana, but we've got to bring this to a close. But one of the cool things about, I love about having specialist guests, is that I can invite you to close, if you like, by giving us what you see as your top take-home message for our listeners generally, and especially for those wanting to factor climate change into their thinking on the coming local government elections. Although we haven't talked much about local government, that's one of the impetuses for this series that we're running. So I'd love to get your top take-home message for our listeners, and framed in that context as far as you wish.
Yeah, thank you, Lindsay. You know, I think, you know, if you want to factor climate change into action, it's not going to be through some of our, you know, current leadership models. And, you know, I acknowledge that we've got more projects, you know, on the go, which is great. But, you know, to see the change that we need, we need scalable solutions. If we as a people and communities are committed to being tūpuna pono, to be good ancestors, then new approaches are needed. And, you know, I'm not interested really in tinkering around the edges anymore. You know, we're at a position where we need to make some fundamental a change that's both, you know, intergenerational and generative in its approach. You know, three-year cycles don't help. The long haul is here, our Māori business, and, of course, our citizens. So we need to step up. it's really important that any actions and priorities that we identify has the well-being of our natural world at its centre.
Hmm.
And I fundamentally believe that this new opportunity, Te Tiriti, is our way forward. It is about partnership.
Hmm.
And that if we're mature enough to have a look at a new way of doing things that has Te Tiriti at its centre, then there's no stopping us. Hmm. So I'm all for a new regional leadership model. And perhaps at another conversation, Lindsay, we can go into more detail in
terms that would be so
what that looks like. But, you know, that's, you know, I think our solutions have to be at scale and we need new leadership.
Mariana, that's a powerful and wonderful take-home message. Thank you. And I think it's a great note on which to finish. A very strong thing in itself, but also pointing to a journey for the future as well. So that's great. So kia ora, Mariana, and tēnā koe for your wonderful contribution. It's been lovely having a conversation with you, and I hope it's not long before we have another one.
Kia ora. Thank you. Thank you, Lindsay.
I just love the multidimensional expertise all of our guests bring to this series, and there is so much in Mariana's insights that I'd love to have unpicked further with her. She certainly strengthened comments of some of our other guests around the likes of governance and community and regenerating nature. Now, as always, I'll give you listening options for the series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. You can listen to the full interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these, along with information about the series, are available on our website, which is www.resilience.co.nz, where you can easily navigate to our podcast page, and there you'll be able to link to podcasts which are up on Spotify and Apple and other main podcast platforms. That will also give you access to the full schedule of the information, as well as to the Fresh FM broadcasting frequencies and to podcasts of the radio shows, where most of the interviews are condensed to about half their length. As always, a big thanks to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, who does invaluable work as the sound tech and getting this up into podcast format. And of course, a big thanks to you too, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this important discussion. We have just two more experts left to join us in this series. It's amazing that we're nearing the end of it. Next is Dr. Olivia Hyatt, as mentioned earlier, and then in the final episode, a summing up interview with no less than the amazing Professor Bronwyn Hayward. Do join us for those. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.